You're always welcome to throw something as long as it's not hard. Okay. Some people call those early years of the exile the lying and deception years, because that seemed to be the principle that David was operating on. His faith wavered significantly early on there, and he did some things that put him in some precarious situations and might seem a little bit odd to us, like going down to Goliath's hometown and asking him, is it all right for him to hang there for a while with his sword on his back, Goliath's sword on David's back? And they thought, hey, this guy is nuts. He had to act like he was nuts to keep him from killing him, and so he did. And they let him go, and he ran around for a while. Then we got into the second phase. It's called the Judean exile, and that's primarily because he's running around here in the Judean wilderness, which is long in through here. So the second phase of his exile in that 10-year window is kind of geographically centered in that particular area. And so you could have the first phase or the deception phase, and then you could have the Judean phase, which we haven't quite finished yet. We will. And then there'll be the third phase, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. So he's moving from place to place. He's built him up an army of about 600 guys. These guys are bad news in the army. He's got a very, very good, capable group of soldiers working with him here. And we'll see more about them later. But at any rate, when we left off last time, David had married a second wife. Her name was Abigail. But he had another wife as well. Her name was Ahinoam, I think is how her name would be pronounced. So he's got two wives now at this particular point in time. They're dragging around through the desert there with him. And his first wife was taken back from him by Saul and given to another guy. So he's actually now had three wives at some point in time, two of which he still has. So let's pick up the trail in 1 Samuel 26:1. The Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, well, is not David hiding on the hill of Hachilah, which is before Jeshimon? So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having with him 3,000 chosen men of Israel to search for David in the wilderness of Ziph. And he came and camped at a certain place in the hill of Hachilah, I guess it's called, which is before Jeshimon, beside the road. And David was staying in the wilderness when he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. David sent out spies, and he knew that Saul was definitely coming. So David then arose and came to the place where Saul had camped. And David saw the place and where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of the army. And Saul was laying in the circle of the camp, and the people were camped around him. So Saul has brought his army out there after David again. And he is camped there on the ground, and he's in the center of a circle, and his army and his bodyguards and those guys are kind of sleeping and camped around him. You know, that's, you got to walk over them, step on their faces to get to Saul, so to speak. And David sees all of that. So he answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, Jacob's brother, saying, who will go down with me to Saul in the camp? I'm going to put the sneak on this guy. Will one of you guys go with me? And Abishai said, yeah, I'll go down with you. So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and they sneak up on Saul. And behold, he was sleeping inside the circle of the camp with his spear stuck in the ground at his head. And Abner and the people were lying around him. You got the scene in mind? Big bad Saul just laying there on the ground sleeping. All of his bodyguards right around him. He's got his spear stuck in the ground beside his head so he could get to it quickly, I suppose, if he had to, wake up quickly and do something. Then David and one of his soldiers go with him, and they sneak into this camp. Then Abishai said to David, today God has delivered your enemy into your hand. Now, therefore, please let me strike him with the spear to the ground with one stroke, and I will not strike him a second time. he asked David to give him permission to pin Saul to the ground with his own spear. And he'll take care of him and kill him off with one strike. And since David's been running from this guy for, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, something like that maybe, that sounds like a pretty good offer, doesn't it? I think I'd take him up on that one and said, well, maybe I'll even do it myself instead of you doing it. But we get good insight into David's character here in verse 9 and 10, that I think answers the question we asked earlier on, is what does it mean when God says David is a man after his own heart? What's that mean? Because we know David's got all kinds of flaws. But look what he says in verse 9 and 10. David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt?" Now, David has such a high regard for God's anointed king here, even though he's been trying to kill David, and even though he's obviously displayed some woeful characteristics, David doesn't want to lay a hand on the guy in harm. And David also says, "As the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him, or his day will come that he dies, and he will go down into battle and perish." David said, "I'm going to leave this to God to take care of this guy Saul. I know I can kill him." He could have killed him at the porta potty cave earlier, remember? Real golden opportunity there, and he didn't take advantage of that because of the same high reverence and regard that David has for God's chosen and God's plan and purpose for people. So he says, "No, I'm not going to kill him. I'm going to leave that up to God." He's not quoting the New Testament, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." He's just not going to do it. He's not going to take vengeance on Saul. "The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed, but now please take the spear that is at his head and the jug of water and let us go." So they take some evidence that they've been there. They take Saul's spear and his water jug and they hook him. "So David took the spear and a jug of water from beside Saul's head and he went away, but no one saw or knew it. Nor did any awake, for they were all asleep, because a sound sleep from the Lord had fallen on them." Lord put a little stupor on them there, just like he put on the nation Israel, Romans chapter 11. He kept them sound asleep. So now David's a sneaky guy. We've seen him at work before. I don't know if he needed this or not, but he got the Lord's help here, and he was able to get in there, take that spear and the water jug, and leave. So, a second time now, David has spared the guy, right? The cave of Adullam, the porta-potty cave, and this time, a second time, he has spared Saul's life when he could easily have taken it. So he crossed over to the other side and stood on top of the mountain at a distance with a large area between them. And David called to the people and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, "Will you not answer Abner?" Then Abner answered and said, "Who are you who calls to the king?" Remember who Abner is? He's the head of Saul's army. He's also his cousin. He's responsible for protecting Saul. And David says, "Hey, Saul, hey Abner, look what I got in my hand. Your boss's sword and his water jug." So David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel?" In other words, he was highly respected, very capable military man, and he's allowed David to walk right into this camp and steal Saul's sword, or his spear. "Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For if the people came to destroy the king, your lord," or one of the people, "this thing that you have done is not good." In other words, Abner, you're a miserable failure protecting Saul. "As the Lord lives, all of you must surely die, because you did not guard your Lord." So he kind of pronounces this curse on the bodyguard team, the Lord's anointed. "And now see where the king's spear is and the jug of water that was at his head." It's right here in my hand, guys. I got it. And Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And David said, "It is my voice, my lord the king." And he also said, "Well, why then is my Lord pursuing his servants? For what have I done? Or what evil is in my hand?" it's got to be frustrating for David to try to speak rationally to this guy. He at times has shown some rational thought. At other times, he looks like he's the craziest loon on the planet. So David is trying to speak rationally here, and he seems to be understanding at this time. That is, Saul seems to be understanding. Now, therefore, please let my lord the king listen to the words of his servant. This is David speaking. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. That is, if I have done something wrong, I will go through the normal processes of submitting sin offerings and that sort of thing to take care of the matter. Let him accept an offering, but if it is men, that is, if men have stirred this thing up, cursed are they before the Lord, for they have driven me out today that I should have no attachment with the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. David is frustrated that Saul's pursuit of him, in essence, is driving him out of Israel and the ability to function in his own country through the sacrificial systems and that sort of thing. Saul is sort of making him this exile by chasing after him. Now then, do not let my blood fall to the ground away from the presence of the Lord, for the king of Israel has come out to search for a single flea, just as one hunts a partridge in the mountains. David likened himself to an insignificant nobody that people could hunt all the time, and Saul's treating him like that. Then Saul says, I have sinned. Is that the response you would have expected at this point in time?
No.
Kind of a little surprising, isn't it, that he's showing this kind of good sense. He says, return, my son David, for I will not harm you again, because my life was precious in your sight this day. I don't know, Saul. I don't know if I can believe that or not, dear pal. And he goes on, Saul goes on to say, behold, I have played the fool and have committed a serious error. Now, when you see this passage, if you didn't see all the others that we've seen, it would look like Saul has repented and has repented honestly and openly and recognized that he has indeed been foolish in his interaction with David and has committed a serious error. You willing to bet your farm on the fact that he's serious and that this is genuine repentance? I'd be a little skeptical if I was David. He's played the fool. There's the epitaph for Saul's tombstone. I've played the fool. What in the world does that mean? Well, one of our more noted writers, a guy named J. Sidlow Baxter, has described this in one of his writings, and here's a little summary of what he has put together for us. A man plays the fool when he neglects his godly friends, as Saul neglected Samuel. A man plays the fool when he goes on enterprises for God before God has sent him, as Saul did. A man plays the fool when he disobeys God, even in seemingly small matters, as Saul first did. It was a small matter to him to not kill the Amalekites like he was sent to do, but it wasn't a small matter to God. A man plays the fool when he tries to cover up his disobedience to God by religious excuses, but Samuel reminded him to obey is better than sacrifice. A man plays the fool when he tries to persuade himself that he is doing the will of God, as Saul tried to persuade himself, when all the time deep down in his heart he knew otherwise. A man plays the fool when he allows some jealousy or hatred to master and enslave and deprave him, as Saul did toward David. A man plays the fool when he knowingly fights against God, as Saul did hunting down David to try to save his own face. A man plays the fool when he turns from God, from the God he has grieved, and seeks an alternative in spiritism and in trafficking with spirits in the beyond. All these ways of sin and folly is moral and spiritual suicide. We can only finish any such downgrade course with the pathetic groan of Saul, I have played the fool. He seems to understand his life, but we have good reason to be cautious and suspicious that he really does understand, don't we? Saul's life is going to end up here before long. We'll see it in about as tragic a way as we can imagine. And if you were going to summarize this man's life in just a few words, this is what you would say: Saul played the fool in his life. And he recognizes it here. Reminds me of this Christian hymn, Wasted Years. You ever heard that? Saul's life was wasted years. And unfortunately, the repentance doesn't seem to be genuine, as we'll see going forward. But that's how he reacts. He recognizes that David could have killed him easily, since David's standing there holding the spear that was in the ground beside his head just a little bit ago. And David answered and said, "Behold, the spear of the king. Now let one of the young men come over and take it." Why doesn't he also send back the water jug? Would you drink out of that water jug if David had it and sent it back to you? You might want to have it chemically analyzed first. Could be something in it. So they didn't ask for the water jug back. "The Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I refuse to stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. And now behold, as your life was highly valued in my sight this day, so may my life be highly valued in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me from all distress." And Saul said to David, "Blessed are you, my son David. You will both accomplish much and surely prevail." So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. They did not get together. They went their separate ways. But Saul seems to be, at the second sparing of his life by David, remorseful. Seems to be. Says he is. But it's hard to have any confidence in anything Saul says. So this event kind of concludes now this middle phase of the exile. The Judean wilderness wanderings ends with this particular incident. So we're about, I think the last phase only took like a year and 4 months. We're like about 8.5 years into this 10-year exile with the conclusion of this second event. So two times David could have easily killed Saul. Two times he spares Saul's life. Two times he acknowledges that he's not going to harm God's anointed. He's going to leave that in God's hands to take care of it however he wants to. His reverence for the things of God is very, very high. And I think that's the essence of what it means to be a man after God's own heart. It's a man that values what God values, that reveres what God reveres. And David was that guy, in spite of some of the other problems he has. All right. Now, let's get into phase three of this whole thing. As I mentioned before, we've seen David's life kind of like a roller coaster ride. When his faith wavers, he sort of slides down to the bottom of the hill, doesn't he? He does sort of irrational things. Things that don't seem to make a lot of sense. Things that certainly don't seem to have God's seal of approval on them. And other times, he does things by faith and is very admirable in that regard. Well, here we go into phase 3 in chapter 27. In fact, phase 3 will take the rest of the book. 27 through 31 are all part of that third phase of David's exile. These last 5 chapters. So, David, after a while, comes to this conclusion, verse 1 of chapter 27. David said to himself, "Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. So there's nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. So then Saul will stop searching for me anymore in the territory of Israel, and I'll escape from his hands." What makes him conclude that? Has he not been told that he is the next king of Israel? Why does he think Saul is going to kill him? And that it makes good sense for him to flee down to the Philistine territories and hang out with them again. Remember, we saw that early on when he first started to flee. He made that irrational judgment. He's making the same irrational judgment here. Saul's going to get me one of these days, so I'll just go down there and live with those guys and he'll leave me alone. He doesn't know that. In fact, he should know that that isn't going to happen. He's been told by Samuel that he is the next king. So he's not going to get killed off by Saul. What in the world has happened to his thinking here? We've noted before that this ever-present ongoing conflict between walking by sight and walking by faith is there all the time in our lives. It's a battle that goes on all the time. And David is wrestling with it here, and he's losing at this particular time, and concluding, without even talking to God about it, that, hey, you know what I'll do? I'm going to go hang down here with these Philistine guys, and Saul won't come over here looking for me. That's my best move. So I'm going to go do that. When our faith wavers, it's very commonplace that we make bad decisions. We put ourselves in precarious situations before God. Oftentimes, God has to come in and clean it up for us, fix the mistakes that we've done. Remember Abraham and Sarah? She's my sister. So don't be killing me to get to her. She's just my sister. And she gets put in some guy's harem? How comfortable is that for Sarah? Big mistake. Walking by sight. Hey, I got to protect myself here from these guys. I'll just tell them she's my sister. And God comes in and puts a whammy on them and cleans that all up. But that's not the way we want to live. It's not our job to go about seeing what messes we can make out of our faithless lives and expect God to clean it all up for us. The big idea is to walk by faith, not by sight. And David is slipping down the roller coaster pretty badly here right now. So that's his thinking, though. I want to protect myself by going and hanging out and buddying up with these Philistines, people that I've killed, you know, hundreds of times. They won't mind me, I'm sure. So he arose and he crossed over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish, the son of Maok, the king of Gath. So this guy is the king of one of their cities, one of the Philistine cities up there. And the Achish is a title like Pharaoh. So this may not be the same guy that encountered David when he was acting like a lunatic earlier. Remember that? He had to pretend to be insane to get out of that place. This is maybe a different guy. So it may be that explains why there's no great reaction to David going down there. But he goes down there. He's got 600 men. So if you were the king of this city of Achish, and this guy comes to you with a well-trained 600-man army and says, why don't I hang with you for a while? What would you do? You'd be glad to get that army, wouldn't you? So he's, I'm sure, inclined to welcome David and his army with him. He probably has heard of the rift between David and Saul, and so that further probably motivates this guy Achish to welcome David with open arms, because now all of a sudden the enemy of his enemy is his friend. So David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each with his own household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. And was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he no longer searched for him. Well, that part worked out like he thought. Saul did stop searching for him, but he and his army and all their families, their wives and kiddos and whoever they got in tow, they're all living down there now in Philistine territory there at Gath. There were five cities along the coast there and that comprised the Philistines, and this is one of them. So David's there. He's got his wife in tow. Wife's in tow, and he, it looks like his thinking has pay dividends. Well, if you look at the result of Abraham, after he told them that his wife was his sister, it looked like he did good too. God blessed him with stuff, but clearly that was a bonehead play on his part. So David says to Achish, living down there, he says, "Now, if I have found favor in your sight, let them give me a place in one of the cities in the country that I may live there. For why should your servant live in the royal city with you?" So David says, "Hey, give me a place to live. I'll take my armies and we'll go live in this other city rather than living in your face. And we'll do some work for you. We'll serve you." So Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Therefore, Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. And the number of days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. So the king of Gath gives him this city down here in the country, Ziklag. So he brings his entourage down there, and they set up shop down there in that city. And this guy, Achish, who has given him this place, he's of course, expecting that David will serve him and raid the Israelites and the other people around in that area and be one of David's guys. So he at least is given some sort of a remote place there to stay. And he stayed there 1 year and 4 months. So as strange as it may seem, it's working out. God is making it work out, even though it has the earmarks of foolishness all over it. So David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites and the Gerzites and the Amalekites. They were the inhabitants of the land from ancient times as you come to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. These are guys down in the south. These various tribes that he's raiding here are down here, down in this area. Various tribes that occupied that territory for quite some time. Now, to keep Achish from really knowing what he's doing, he attacked the land and did not leave a man or a woman alive. He took away the sheep, the cattle, the donkeys, the camels, and the clothing, and he returned and came to Achish. So he goes out on these raids, and to make sure nobody escapes and explains to Achish what he's actually doing, he kills everybody. Zaps them all. So there are no witnesses that who he is killing isn't who Achish thinks it is. Achish thinks he's off killing Israelites. But he's not. He's killing the enemies of the Israelites, and Achish doesn't know that. He's fooled. So he goes back up to Achish and kind of reports in. Verse 10, and Achish says, "Well, where have you made a raid today?" And David said, "Well, against the Negev of Judah and against the Negev of the Jerahmeelites and against the Negev of the Canaanites." In other words, the south desert portion of these Israeli tribes. He said, "That's where we've been raiding, down there in the south of Israel," which be all down here. So Achish now thinks David is out there doing his bidding, whipping up on these Israelite tribes living there in the south. So David did not leave a man or a woman to bring to Gath, saying, "Lest they should tell about us," saying, "So has David done, and so has been his practice all the time he has lived in the country of the Philistines." So nobody is left alive to report back to the Philistines that David is actually killing the enemies of Israel, not Israel. That's a pretty precarious situation, isn't it? To keep pulling that off for 1 year and 4 months. So Achish believed David. saying, well, he has surely made himself odious among his people in Israel, therefore he'll be my servant forever. He thinks that David is doing what he says, and therefore the Israelites are going to hate him. So Achish says, well, I'll just make him my bodyguard. He's my guy now. He's out there doing what I tried to do but couldn't get done. He's a good guy to have. So one could call this phase of the exile, like the first phase of the exile, the time period of lies and deception, couldn't he? Same thing going on again. His faith has wavered. His decisions and actions are based upon living by sight, and he's doing exactly the same thing that he did early on, lying about things and deceiving people. Now, he's deceiving the enemies of Israel, so you could look at it a little differently maybe than if he was just trying to deceive his own people, but that's what he's doing. Now, it came about in those days that the Philistines gathered their armed camps for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, know assuredly that you will go up with me in the camp, and you and your men. And David said to Achish, very well, you know what your servant can do. So Achish said to David, very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life. Now this guy is so impressed with David, with what he thinks David is doing, that he's now going to make him his bodyguard for life. And David implies in his conversation to him, you know what your servant can do. Well, yeah, but I'm doing it to you, Achish, and that's what you don't know. So he is tricking them all. But here's the dilemma he's creating for himself. Now that he is so well received by the Philistines, and they want him to join them in their fight against Israel, how is he going to avoid fighting Israel, his own people? How is he going to do that? Because he's pretended to be a servant of the Philistines. You see between the rock and a hard place he's gotten himself in here? Now, what happens next is one of the more bizarre stories that you will find anywhere in Scripture, maybe the most bizarre. Let's look at this a little bit. Now, Samuel was dead, so there's no way of consulting one of God's prophets for Saul. All Israel had lamented him and buried him in Ramah, his own city, and Saul had removed from the land those who were mediums and spiritists. So with Samuel gone, Saul tried to eliminate all of these witches and mediums and necromancers and people like that from the land. As background information. So the Philistines gathered together and came and camped at Shunem, and Saul gathered all of Israel together, and they camped in Gilboa. So they're going up the... Well, this map ain't got them on there. Let's see if I got another one that does. Well, I can tell you well enough without having to show you. What's happening here is the Philistines are moving up the coast. They're coming up here, and Saul and his guys are coming up here, and they're going to run into one another up there a little ways at this place called Gilboa. Okay, so the Philistine army is moving north along the coast. Saul and the Israeli army is moving north inland a little bit. Yeah, I guess I don't have a map that shows that. But anyway, that's what's going on here. And when Saul saw the camp of the Philistines, he was afraid and his heart greatly trembled. Now, the reason for that is because the plain where the Philistines have moved their army into was very conducive to using their chariots, their tanks, in other words, and Saul didn't have any. He doesn't want to fight anybody on an open plain because the enemy's chariots can run over his army. He knows that. He'd rather be fighting them in the mountains or someplace like that. So when he sees them gathering up there into that place, He's greatly afraid. Well, why didn't he go ask Samuel what's going to happen here? Samuel ain't there anymore, is he? So he's got a problem. So Saul inquired of the Lord, and the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by the prophets. So he asked God, and God says, I'm not talking to you anymore, Saul. Your chance is come and gone. So he says to his servants, well, seek for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her. Find me a witch, guys. I got to go get some information here. Now, clearly he hadn't done a real good job of ridding the land of all of these people, because they can go find him one pretty easily here. His servant said to him, hey, I know where there's a woman. Is a medium at Endor as compared to outdoors. I don't think that's on here, is it? I don't see it. At any rate, up in that area up north there where these armies are meeting and where he's going to go, there is a witch up there, or a medium that his servants knew about. And guy says, hey, I know where there's one. I know a guy who knows a guy. So they go up there. Saul disguised himself by putting on other clothes. Why would he do that? Because remember, he has rid the country of these people. If they see him coming, they know they're dead meat. So he's got to disguise himself and not look like he's Saul the king, or they're not going to help him in any way. He's supposed to have cleaned them all out. So he puts on other clothes and went, he and two men with him. Abner is not mentioned as being one of those two men, but two men went with him, and they came to the woman by night and said, conjure up for me, please, and bring me up, and bring up for me whom I shall name to you. So he goes and finds this witch, he and his two guys, and they say, hey, we want you to have a seance and bring this guy up to speak to us. Got the picture? But the woman said to him, behold, you know what Saul has done. She doesn't know it's Saul here. How he has cut off those who are mediums and spirits from the land. Why are you then laying a snare for my life to bring about my death? They're saying, in effect, hey, if I do this for you and Saul finds out, hey, I'm dead. And Saul vowed to her by the Lord, swears by the Lord that won't talk to him, saying, as the Lord lives, there shall be no punishment come upon you for this thing. So she's trying to protect her own hide, and he assures her that nobody's going to find out about this, and she's not going to be in any trouble. So she says, okay then, whom shall I bring up for you? And he said, bring up Samuel for me. He wants Samuel to come back from the dead and talk to him. Now, is this a normal practice? We see this going on all the time in Scripture. There's a lot of people try to present a scene of this sort, but there is nothing in Scripture that says that this is the norm or an acceptable practice of any kind. So she goes through her whatever she does here, and when she saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. When she sees Samuel, it scares the daylights out of her. She didn't expect this to work like this. She knows that her hokey pokey is just a bunch of junk, and it's some kind of a deception of some way. Perhaps there's some satanic involvement. Perhaps there's demonic involvement. I don't know. But she certainly did not expect to see actual Samuel there. And so when she sees him, she screeches and says, why have you deceived me? For you are Saul. She knows that the only person that would want to talk to Samuel would be Saul, the supposed representative prophet of the kingdom from God to them. She knows that this now is Saul in her presence there. And he says to her, verse 13, don't be afraid. What do you see? And the woman says, I see a divine being coming up out of the earth. And he said to her, well, what is his form? And she said, an old man is coming up, and he is wrapped with a robe. Now, no one ever accused Samuel of being a fashion plate. He's wearing the same garb that he had on before when he died. So when the witch describes Samuel, Saul recognizes this is Samuel. This is his garment. This is the way he dressed. This is the way he was. And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed his face to the ground and did homage. So Samuel is now there in their presence, dressed like he was before he left, recognizable to Saul as God's man. This is not some faker. This is not some prophet wannabe that she's managed to conjure up satanically or whatever. This is Samuel. So he hits the ground and pays homage to Samuel. So then Samuel said to Saul, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? He doesn't sound like he's all that happy to be there, does he? He said, what are you doing here, Saul? I was resting in peace in my eternal state, finally wearing a different change of clothes than I had to wear all my life, and you bring me back in this garb. What in the world are you doing? So Saul answered and said, well, I'm greatly distressed, for the Philistines are waging war against me, and God has departed from me and answers me no more, either through prophets or by dreams. Therefore, I have called you that you may make known to me what I should do. If I may translate, my bacon is about to get burned. I need help, Saul says to Samuel. He doesn't know how to handle this situation. So that's what he's done. He's asked this witch to bring Samuel back so that he, Saul, can get some information that he, Saul, wants to have. She didn't know who it was. She didn't know she could do this. Clearly, it is not her who has done this. But God has done this. So Samuel says, well, why did you ask me since the Lord departed from you and has become your adversary? He said, what do you expect to get from me, Saul? God is not talking to you. And the Lord has done accordingly as he spoke through me. The Lord has done this, whatever in the world this is. For the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor, to David. Now we know that Samuel told Saul before that the kingdom has been torn from him and given to his neighbor, but he wasn't named. The neighbor wasn't named. This is the first time Saul has been told point blank that the guy that's going to replace him is David. Saul might have suspected that, but this time God tells him that that's who it is. As you did not obey the Lord and did not execute his fierce wrath on Amalek, so the Lord has done this thing to you this day. That act of disobedience earlier and not killing all the Amalekites like it was supposed to, that's what's brought about this judgment on Saul. So there can be no mistake in Saul's mind that this is a message from God, and it is a message that he has brought about on himself through the disobedience that we've seen him do before. So there's no reason at all for him to think this is some kind of satanic charlatan of some kind. This is Samuel, and he is telling Saul what God is going to do. Moreover, the Lord will also give over Israel along with you into the hands of the Philistines. Therefore, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. That is, they'll be dead where I'm dead. Indeed, the Lord will give over the army of Israel into the hands of the Philistines. Now, that's probably not the message that Saul was looking for. That's probably not the most comforting message that he could get. His army is going to be defeated by the Philistines. He and his sons are all going to die in that battle. He's probably wishing he'd never heard of that witch now, huh? The judgment of God on Saul because of his repeated disobedience is now about to be made complete. Saul hits the ground, very afraid because of the words of Samuel. And there was no strength in him. He's wasted, for he's not eating any food all day and all night. And so the woman came to Saul and saw that he was terrified and said to him, "Behold, your maidservant has obeyed you, and I've taken my life in my hand, and I've listened to your words which you spoke to me. So now please listen to the voice of your maidservant. Let me set a piece of bread before you that you may eat and have strength when you go on your way." He needs to eat, and she can recognize that much. And she says, "Look, let me fix you something to eat here." But he refused and said, "I'll not eat." However, his servants together with the woman urged him, and he listened to them. So he rose from the ground and sat on the bed. And the woman had a fattened calf in the house, and she quickly slaughtered it and took flour, kneaded it, and baked unleavened bread from it. She didn't get time to let bread rise, so she just bakes what she's got. And she brought it before Saul and his servants, and they ate, and then they rose and went away that night. What a weird happening. Who has ever come back from the dead and spoken to men like Samuel did in this event? Has there ever been anybody come back from the dead and speak to men like this? Can you think of any other event, anywhere, anytime, that took place? What's that?
Christ with the disciples.
You know, the transfiguration, is that what you're referring to? Yeah, remember that, Matthew 17? Two guys came back from the dead there and spoke to him. Who were they? Moses and Elijah. But they came from glory. They were there representing the millennial kingdom that was going to be set up soon. Samuel, in this case, seems to come from the abode of the dead and actually is allowed to communicate again with living human beings. So this event is really kind of unique. It's unprecedented. The other event, of course, the transfiguration comes much later, but that seems to be in a little different category than this one. This one is so bizarre, so unusual, so odd. Don't conclude anything in principle from it, other than the fact that God had a message for Saul.
I wonder if people that perform seances point to this.
They probably leverage off of it somehow, don't they? Probably get some encouragement from it somehow, probably, unfortunately. And there are numerous explanations for this other than simply that God brought Samuel back, but there's reason to reject all of those different explanations. They're satanic in nature, they're psychotic in nature, and there's all kinds of other forms of deception that might be going on. But I think that's a waste of time to try to figure that out. It looks like it's simply the will of God that he come back and tell Saul this message of judgment that he told him.
Remember the story of Lazarus? And the rich man, mm-hmm. They had the conversation about he wanted to.
Yeah.
Kind of
set some parameters, doesn't it? In that incident between Lazarus and the rich man, he said, "Look, you can't cross over here to where we are. We can't communicate because there's a great gulf fixed between us. And I'm not going to send somebody to go warn your brothers or whatever. If they don't believe the guys that are already there, they're not going to believe me." So it looks like that is much more of a normative situation than this one. This one just looks absolutely one of a kind. The only person that could ever come back and speak to men was Samuel. And he knows the future because God told him the future. Otherwise, who would know the future? You could bring some kind of demon back in this situation. They wouldn't know the future necessarily. But Samuel does because God told him. Bessie. Not the first time.
Yeah,
he just gave it to his neighbor. Okay. This time he says, he's giving it to your neighbor who is David.
Okay.
So here he gets the label. Then he did not. You would think he might have put two and two together back then, but here he's flat out told that David is going to replace him.
So in the first one, he didn't say David.
No.
He didn't use the name. This is the first.
When Saul tore Samuel's robe the first time when he left, the name David was not used.
Okay.
Well, Jonathan knew, didn't he?
What's that?
Jonathan.
What's that?
Didn't he know that David was going to be the next king? Jonathan, Saul's son.
What about him?
Didn't he know that David was going to be the next king?
Yeah. Because he wanted to be the second in command, and he was willing to give up his claim to the throne, which was a robe. Saul just never accepted it, apparently. It's hard to say what he knew, but it appears that he did not accept it for sure.
So that's why he wanted to kill him, because he kind of knew that he was going to be king.
Oh, I think his jealousy. You know, when the Israeli chicks came up with that song that humiliated Saul at David's expense, I think he got so jealous that he just wanted to kill him from that point forward. He knew David was sniffing around the kingdom from that point on. So, don't conclude anything from this event other than God is sovereign of the living and God is sovereign of the dead. He can do whatever he wants to. Men can't. Witches can't. But God can. And so conclude that safely if you want to, but don't conclude that men have the authority and power to bring back the dead. They don't. But they can probably make a lot of money faking it some way and getting their clients to pay big bucks to hear some kind of nonsense that they know they want them to hear. So chalk it up as a very, very bizarre and unique experience, but don't go much further than that with it. You'll be concluding the wrong things, I think. Any other questions or comments about this incident so far? Saul has got the handwriting on the wall. His last meal was this fattened calf and some homemade bread. I guess it beats nothing. That's the last time he's going to eat anything, as we'll see next time. Questions, comments? We'll meet two more Thursdays, concluding on the 15th. Then we'll skip two and get back to work in January. I'll send you reminders in email. Be sure and check your email. Always check your emails anyway, because this time of year we could get weather. I could wake up sick. Anything can happen. So always check your emails. Okay? We'll let you roll. You have a good week. Drive safely.